It's 5:03 a.m. on Friday, July 21st. It's still dark as hell outside. Things are pretty quiet, occasional bike going by. I'm up, getting ready to think about heading up the hill. You wait too long, the shuttles are going to be jam-packed. Anyway, day one, first practice, up in a few hours. Hot damn. Talk to you later.
The lights are on red. We're away.
Welcome to MotoGPOD, the internet radio show all about motorcycle road racing. I'm your long-lost host, Jim Race, and I believe this is episode number 70. Now, I've got no good way to explain my absence, so let me simply say that I'm sorry I've been gone. There's been a lot going on, a lot with work, and I will try and do my best going forward to make sure that I can get you shows as soon as possible. In the meantime, what's happened is I've basically got a bunch of content backed up. And so I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time talking about much. Brno is coming up this weekend after a long, long break, a three-week break after Laguna Seca. There will be a little bit of you notice the lead in there with me. That was from day one at Laguna Seca. And I'm simply going to close out the show with a thank you, and I hope you enjoy the races this weekend. Should be fun, and what I have coming up for you is a real treat, because it's been a while since we've had Liam on. I've got an extremely long interview, so I hope you'll bear with, and the download wasn't too painful. And again, thanks for listening, and we will see you next week, and I'll do a little lead out at the end, too.
All right, well, this is Jim Race here, and at last we have Liam Schubert on the phone. Liam, welcome to MotoGPOD after a long time away.
Thanks. It's very good to be here, to be reunited, I guess, in a way, with the United States and MotoGPOD. So thanks for having me, Jim.
I'm very, very pleased to have you. It's been quite some time since we talked, and I looked back and I thought about the things that have been going on, and I think the last time was prior to Catalunya, which almost seems forever ago, but a lot of things happened since then, and I'm kind of going to give you the opportunity to catch us up, because while I've talked to our audience about a lot of the events that have to do with the race, I'd really like to hear what's happened with you since then. And I know Catalunya for you was kind of a turning point in a lot of different ways. So drop us all the way back there, if you could.
Okay. Well, let's see. I worked the Mugello round. I spoke with Bob. And then I'm not sure if I had a call with the three of us. But Catalunya was the kickoff for a three race weekends in a row, starting with Catalunya, then going to Holland for Assen, and then over to England to wrap up with the Donington round. And Catalunya was probably the second hottest round of the season so far, one of the hotter races, and an incredibly stressful race on race day. Everybody had done as much prep as we could through Friday and Saturday, and, you know, come race day, we were geared up for some racing, and we ended up going through three restarts, which was incredibly taxing, and everybody was worried about fuel requirements. Like, you know, if you topped off before the first restart or the first start, then you had to do another lap and then sit and wait and warm the bike up and then do another lap. We were a little worried about fuel consumption through the length of the race. So Catalunya was a rough race in a lot of ways, and everybody was really stressed out. And even after the racing was over and we packed up our trucks and had dinner on Sunday night, I mean, our thoughts were with the injured riders. So that was a dark race for a lot of people. And my team included, even though we didn't have any any part of the mishap, we, you know, everybody cares about what's going on with everybody else. And so it was a quiet dinner, and then I went out and had a couple of drinks with John Hopkins and Alex Hoffman and a couple of us. And somewhere along the course of the night in beautiful Barcelona, I got my wallet pickpocketed. So by the time morning runs around and I realize, hey, I don't have any of my gear, I wasn't able to get to the airport and make my flight to go to Holland, which meant some rapid scrambling, and I was a day late to get to Holland. So more work for my team to do on the day that I was absent, and not very cool in a lot of ways, mostly because I, you know, in a foreign country, it's difficult to communicate with the police and you know, make heads or tails of the legality of things. Like, you can just say, I reported it lost, and they're like, well, you're a tourist anyway, so, you know, we're not going to bother looking for it. You're going to be out of our country before we even need to think about it. So better just cancel your credit card. And,
Yeah.
Well, that was difficult, and plus there was a time frame.
Indeed, and that was the point I was going to make, was you were heading into what was the absolute busiest part of the season with nary a rest, and the things that happened between Catalunya and Assen on top of what you had were a huge change for you.
Yeah, it was pretty difficult. I had to borrow money from somebody to get to the airport and pay for a flight change to get to Holland, and then Holland was a difficult weekend, everybody trying to get used to that circuit. But I think right around Holland, there was a different atmosphere that kind of hit the GP series, a little bit in Catalunya, but really in Holland, as the World Cup football matches started to come into play, we started seeing a lot more nationalism within the GP teams. And my own team's represented by a few nationalities. We have two French people, Spanish, Italians, an Argentinian, a Brazilian. So all the football greats were represented on my team. And every afternoon, you know, if we could, for some reason at Holland, we didn't get the TV feed consistently every day during the match times. But, you know, if we could, we'd be watching the football game while we were working on the bikes. And then in the evenings, it was great to be able to watch the game back at the hotel. And it seemed like all of Holland was wearing orange to support their team. And it was really, really interesting to see the different dynamic as you saw not so much team splintering, but there was a lot more ribbing going on in the paddock and during the work there. So that was fun in Holland. I was still broke, so it was difficult for me to even get on the internet that week and try and wrap up some affairs and do some damage control on my personal situation. But we got it worked out so that on Monday after the race, I was in Barcelona for a few hours, almost a day, but managed to get a hold of a wire transfer because you need to be in a specific place to pick up money from Western Union. You can't just put it in Western Union and pick it up anywhere in the world. It's got to know the city. But I managed to grab some money there, and then that enabled me to get to England for the England race. And although my team pays for food and lodging and my travel expenses, there's still expenses relating to me getting to the airport or, you know, feeding myself for a day until I get back with my team and they can start feeding me. So it was a little bit of a stress because my rent money was in the wallet, and just with the timing of things, I had to be ready to be outside of Spain for, you know, a couple of weeks, and that was right around rent time. But England was an interesting race as well.
It's got to be a big panic. Go ahead. When you're in a foreign country and you suddenly find yourself without funds and relying on other folks, and it's great that people there, as well as people around the world and back home, totally helped you out the way you did. I wanted to ask you what as far as the races go from Catalunya to Assen, what kind of change did the team have to make since Hoffman moved over to the factory Ducati team and you took on the relative newcomer, although a Pramac Dantin veteran, as it were, in the European wars with Ivan Silva?
Well, that was kind of interesting. Pramac Dantin is the MotoGP squad, And Dan Teen also runs a national team in the Formula Extreme category in the Spanish National Championship. So it's not related to Pramac, it's just the Dan Teen team. And the technical director on our MotoGP team, a man named Dede, he's French, and he runs the national squad as well. He's the top guy there. And Silva is sort of his protege in the same way that mm-hmm. Puig has been training Pedrosa and others from a young age. Dede has sort of raised Silva up through the ranks until that he's a national contender here in Spain. And when Hoffman got the call to go to the factory team, you know, we immediately made plans. Okay, if anything happens, Silva's going to be our backup. We kind of had that in the back of our minds. And when he came over to our squad, Hoffman's crew of mechanics, myself included, worked with Silva, and our technical director, who was with Cardoso, switched over to our team of mechanics, and the chief mechanic for Hoffman switched over to Cardoso for those races.
Wow.
And that was a little bit of a neat dynamic. I mean, it was we all worked together closely anyway, so it wasn't too much friction, but it was a little unusual, and everybody just we just take it in stride and keep on going. You know, we have a strict timeline. People don't necessarily realize that if anything happens in pre-practice one, we've got less than 3 hours to get it squared away by pre-practice two.
Right.
So we generally hope all the good stuff happens in the first practice, and if anything bad happens, hopefully it's the second practice of the day or qualifying, you know, because then we have all night to kind of work on it. And things do happen. I was really, really impressed with Silva as far as his bike control. I remember seeing on the television some of his lurid wheelies coming out of things.
Yeah.
Because it's a handful of a bike to get used to. I think a lot more difficult to get used to than maybe the Japanese brands, because Ducati is a unique motorcycle. And specifically, I've mentioned this time and again, but the brakes are something else. And so to get used to training yourself to say, okay, I'm going to go in deeper than what's possible on any other, you know, racing motorcycle, it's a definite mind twist to
sure.
You've got to wrap yourself around and just kind of commit and go for it and keep trying to improve. I was reading something with James Ellison that he wrote about how he brakes 20 to 30 meters, or he gets off the gas 20 to 30 meters at the end of a straight before any of the other Yamaha riders. Then they kind of get on the brakes at the same time. And he manages to maintain a higher corner speed through a lot of corners than some of the factory guys. But he says in that time, the 20 to 30 meters, when he rolls off the gas, he settles the bike. As the bike settles, then he gets on the brake. Whereas everybody else, Czech included, will roll off and start braking immediately. So they go in a little bit further before they get on the brakes, and he says he loses a couple tenths here and there each lap per corner in that respect. And it's something he's working on, but not really getting just yet.
Throwing on the binder is heading, well, especially with a GP bike and the speeds that they're able to not only get up to speed as well as stop, especially with the carbon fiber brakes, is something that I don't think any of us mere mortals can wrap our head around. I can imagine, or you can tell me, the first time that Silva stepped off of your guy's bike, I'd have to guess, unless he'd ridden one before, that his eyes were bugging out a little bit.
Yeah, definitely. He looked a little paler, and you could tell he was a bit, he was thrown for a little bit of a loop. Like, here you go, this is the Ferrari on two wheels, and nice to move up from like a Volkswagen Jetta, and here's your Ferrari, now go for it. Actually, what was interesting about him is I've never seen a rider grab the bar so hard in any of my experience, whether it's, you know, people that I know that ride on the street or other racers. And, you know, we really had to strap the grips down hard with multiple safety wires to keep them from moving around.
He was spinning up?
How physically he was. Well, and they were pulling off the bars under acceleration, too.
Wow.
So I think part of it is just because, you know, a lot of riders at this level have learned how to use their entire body and really use their legs to get the bike to transition. And you know, if you're not familiar with that style of riding, you know, you basically, if you're always used to being in a wheelie, you use the bars to kind of crank the bike left to right every time, and that might have had something to do with it. But overall, I think he did a phenomenal job, and he showed improvement. And, you know, I won't say whether or not I think he's a world-level contender, but he definitely showed a lot of promise, and I hope to see him do better in the Spanish championships. I mean, this is a guy with a lot of heart.
The bottom line
is,
too,
is on him, even if
Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, in the Spanish championships, he's a guy that's been running in podium position and had an engine problem, you know, 800 meters from the finish line, which is, I guess that's a half mile, and just got off the bike and ran with it all the way to the finish line, you know, in 100-plus degree conditions in a full suit at the end of a race. You know, that to me, that shows a lot of grit to just say, like, all right, then, I know I'm going to be running and everyone's going to blow past me down the straightaway to get to the finish line, but I'm still going to get this bike over the line with me. So he was a really, really nice guy to work with. His father came with him to all the races, and I wish him the best. It was good working with him.
Cool. So moving on from Assen, and that was quite a finish there. Being an American, I'm sure you were probably watching that as well as watching for your rider, and good for...
Well, that was also a strange... It was strange because I know both of those guys a little bit now, and, you know, I just hope for good racing. I don't really have any personal favorites, but I think it was a really good thing to see that both Americans were willing to do whatever it took, and even though both of them missed the breaking mark for the last bit of the race, you know, it showed that neither one of them wanted to give up, no matter what. And the both of them were willing to just let it all hang out. And that's something that maybe people have accused them of not being able to do or not being willing to do. You know, Colin with his family with him at all the races. In Europe, people say, oh, he never really lets it hang out.
Sure.
And, you know, people have been speaking quite a bit about Nicky. I'm sure that's on a lot of forum boards around the world. But to see both of them up there, you know, rubbing elbows and trading paint and just saying, hell no, I'm going for it. No, I'm going for it. And it just escalating. You know, it was just luck, I think, that made the finish how it was at Assen. But after that race, I wasn't really pumped on it because I felt there was too much unfinished business with that race. You know, I was hoping for a repeat at Laguna Seca to see those two go on tooth and nail. But
that would have been great, but... moving on, Donington, back in Great Britain, land of purportedly bad food, but English-speaking folks for you.
Yeah, English-speaking folks. You know, when I'm with the team, I don't really consider myself an English speaker because, one, the level of my English goes down so that I'm easily understood and I can communicate just the basics. And then to be around all the English people, I have a difficult time understanding certain accents in England. And normally I think I'm pretty good with language, but when it's really thick and very fast and, you know, you mix a couple of pints in there, it gets pretty choppy and difficult for me to understand. So in some ways I just felt, England's another European country and I just don't understand it. But yeah, the weather wasn't bad in England. Food was, well, it was difficult because, you know, if you're traveling with a team, in a lot of other places, we've got little restaurants, you know, tucked away where we're like, okay, the team's been here before, we know the owner, they recognize us, you know, we come here year after year, and you can just roll up.
Yet.
They kind of expect it on a race weekend that you're going to roll up and they're going to have to seat 20 people and crank out some food. But if a place is not really equipped to do that, and it's just an ordinary place, and you show up with 20 guys or 25, they're like, ugh. And, you know, I've been at restaurants where 5 guys will eat and be finished before the next 20 even get their food. And, you know, they feed like 5 at a time some of these smaller places. It's a little funny. I did meet some nice people in England, though. And it was good. I spoke with a man named, I'm blanking on his name. Regardless, he's been a track marshal at Donington for 31 years.
Wow.
And has been to the Isle of Man races 51 times since 1949. So
that's incredible.
Saying that it's 2006 now, and he's been there 51 times. He's missed four races. He got diagnosed with cancer a few years ago, terminal cancer, so he stopped being a track marshal. But that's an incredible devotion to motorcycle racing, and just to speak with him and, you know, hear his enthusiasm and his passion, you know, I wanted to take him into our paddock and just, you know, let him breathe a little bit more. He told me some funny stories about Barry Sheen really, really cool old man. So those are the kind of people that I really relish meeting around the world. It doesn't matter if we speak English together or not, you know, when you meet a true fan of the sport you know, someone like him, an ambassador of sorts, you know, it's really reinforces my desire to stick with it and do my best to put on a good show and just, you know, also meet with people and just share the love. I mean, 51 years at the Isle of Man. My goodness. I feel so guilty for not having made it once, and I'm 30.
Well, there's certain race fans that you'll meet, a short conversation will usually establish that they are people that really love the sport. But when you start seeing the look in people's eyes of absolute passion and devotion for the sport is when you're like, that's the person I want to talk to for a bit, because I can see they really, really love this.
That's true. And although I've been back in California for a few weeks, I'm still in San Francisco right now. I stayed behind to handle some visa requirements for future races and also to take care of my bank and credit card fiasco. You know, I've spent every day meeting with people, whether it's business related or just on a motorcycle level. I haven't really had 6 hours in a row just to myself to, you know, just to sit back and relax like I used to here in California, you know, to sit at my old spots and you know, have some tea or coffee or something. It seems like it's always a mile a minute, and then sometimes you wait for a couple hours and then it's another, you know, mile a minute. And it's been great. You know, I've spoken to a lot of people, and I was really trying to give back to the motorcycle community here in San Francisco. The Bay Area Riders Forum really came together when I lost my wallet. You know, a couple of guys posted up, hey, we got to help Liam. He's overseas. He's got no credit cards, no cash, nothing. And everybody chipped in and PayPal'd somebody, and they put together the Western Union thing. So in my mind, it was like, okay, I'm back. I'm going to make a bunch of events that the Bay Area people put together, you know, whether it's meeting Friday night after the Laguna Seca races to rewatch the race and watch the Doctor, the Tornado, and the Kentucky Kid. You know, I made time in my schedule to go and meet with people and sit down, and so many people, just even at the racetrack, would come up and introduce themselves to me. I was really flattered and just really kind of amazed that people would remember or recognize me. And so I tried to just answer as many questions as I could, or, you know, if I saw somebody had a gleam in their eye, try and give them some pointers. There were a couple of really neat youngsters that came by the garage a couple of times, and, you know, I told them, you know, number one, love motorcycling, and number two, learn a foreign language. It was so cool. One of the fathers said, you know what, we're going to start on our Italian lessons as soon as their rooms are clean. So it was neat, a neat little bait and switch that he gets them to clean their room and they get to learn Italian, which it's necessary. It truly is. And I don't know, in some ways, as international as this race series is, because of the almost mafia control of Italians and the Spanish.
Careful,
mafia
there.
Sounds bad. Let's just say the family atmosphere.
There you go.
You know, I wish there were more English speakers. I mean, there's a couple of South Africans and there's some English naturally involved. Quite a few English, actually. But, you know, I really want to see an American team out there at some point in my life. So who knows what the future will bring in that respect, but I'd really, really like to position myself to learn as much as I can every season and be able to put something together, because I think it's not truly international until everybody's represented. And, you know, as Chris Johnham pointed out in one of his road racer heads, there's only 11 of us that get around to all the races at this point, Americans, that is. And, you know, I want to see a couple more of us.
It's weird because
of all the Japanese people that are involved with the series, and basically the helmet manufacturers, Shoei and Arai, have Japanese service technicians that go to every race and will handle, you know, maintaining the helmets, cleaning them, you know, changing visors, so on and so forth. All the Japanese people, you know, depending if they're in 250 or GP, different teams, it doesn't matter. They still get together and go out and eat, you know, at night if they get a chance. Anywhere in the world, like, hey, I know a Japanese place in Qatar, let's go. And, you know, all of them leave and go together. It'd be kind of good to get together with a couple of Americans and just say, like, oh, thank God we can use words with four syllables. And
well, if there's any MotoGPOD fans out there that would like to have very consistent coverage of the Grand Prix races from an American, feel free to petition to have me work on the world circuit. So zipping through Sachsenring and preparing to head back home to Laguna Seca, I'm sure your thoughts of returning were probably quite anticipatory, as well as perhaps filled with a bit of dread, because you've been in the European continent hardcore for some time, and now you've got to do a big flyaway, and with only weeks prep from Sachsenring, and get ready to go.
Yeah, it was difficult for sure, because for sure. Anyway, after Sachsenring itself was beautiful. Beautiful racetrack. I really enjoyed Germany. Even in the small town of Chemnitz where we were staying, 400,000 people, we found an Italian restaurant that was full of vintage, perfectly restored motorcycles, Italian motorcycles.
How cool
things
was that?
Like old Mike Hailwood Ducatis, 750 GTs or Laverdas. Really custom trick, hand-built machines, just sitting in the windows. And this Italian place was quite a treat, and I met some beautiful people in Germany that I had a really good time hanging out with when I could, you know, after I finished work and had my team dinners and whatnot. Food was excellent. Not at all, you know, what I'd been expecting. I thought, oh, it's going to be really heavy and, you know, lots of meats and sausage and, you know, hardcore food, heavy food, because the people, you know, seem to be on the taller, larger side compared to other places I've been. But the food was really tasty and colorful, and I really enjoyed myself. So after Germany, I got back, and this is at the end of, you know, four races in 5 weeks at that point. No.
Sure.
Three races? Well, whatever. It was
a lot.
For a miniature break. Well, no, not after Germany. Before Germany, it was time for a miniature break, after
right.
England. That was three races in 3 weeks, so I was wiped out physically, sunburned, and just... It took me 2 days to kind of get my bearings back once I was back in Spain, and by then I was still, credit card companies were like, no, we haven't mailed you the cards you requested because you need to fill out an affidavit saying this was stolen, and we've mailed the affidavit to another address in California, and we won't send it to you in Spain, and it was just a mess on the personal level, and then I knew I was coming back to California to stay a few weeks after the race, so... At that point, it was a mad dash to pack up equipment and gear that I could take to Germany, and then immediately after Germany, on Monday, fly from Germany, Munich, to San Francisco. So I knew I needed to bring all that extra stuff with me so that I'd be okay in California for a couple of weeks. And I packed up my bags. Normally, I take one small piece of luggage to the races that has all my work, outfits and you know, a couple of spare shirts and whatnot. But this time I, you know, was bringing my motorcycle boots, motorcycle helmet, riding gear, and, you know, a spare hard drive, just a lot of equipment that I wanted to have in California with me. And
sure.
I get to the airport to fly to Germany, and they're like, oh, your bags are overweight. And I said, well, you know, no big deal. Just tell me what the penalty is and I'll pay it. And he's like, no, it's really overweight. And I'm thinking, you know, how bad can this be? You know, it's two pieces of luggage and a backpack. You know, naturally the backpack goes on the plane with me. And he says, well, it's to get from Barcelona to Germany, it's It's 10 euros per kilogram overweight beef.
Holy cow.
I'm trying to think in my head. I'm like, oh, man, that's a ripoff. Thanks, Lufthansa. And then he goes, but you're 30 kilos overweight. And I'm thinking, oh, my God, that's 300 euros just to get to Germany. So while I'm standing there kind of mulling this over in my head, and he goes, but to fly from Germany to San Francisco, it's not 10 euros per kilogram. It's 30 euros per kilogram overweight beef. And then I was thinking, oh, my goodness, that's 900 euros I'm looking at. So, you know, while I was frantically kind of trying to figure out what I could dump and offload out of my luggage at the airport, he said, well, you know, we made a deal for me to get to Germany. And once in Germany, I kind of explained it to a couple guys on my team. They were smart and brought empty suitcases because they knew they were going to go shopping in California and needed room to bring things back. So I distributed almost a full suitcase amongst my team members after Germany, and once we got into San Francisco, I collected my things back. I didn't have to pay 900 euros overweight fee.
I was picturing you on Sunday night in Germany taking stuff out of your bags and stuffing them into the Premek Don team shipping containers to get them back overseas.
That stuff gets weighed, too. That stuff gets weighed also. And, in fact, that was quite a little fiasco on its own. In its own right, because all the teams packed up all their paddock garages and spare parts boxes and basically everything we thought we would need for the flyaway race. You know, it's a system. Everybody knows the system but me because it's my first year out.
Yep.
And we packed, I guess, about 20 boxes for all of our team equipment that we would be bringing to Laguna Seca. And factory Ducati brought 40 boxes. You know, all the other factory teams, you know, had nearly double what we were bringing. And I was thinking, wow, we're well prepared. Like, we can build a bike out of these boxes, no problem. We're ready. You know, and this is including boxes just filled with, you know, 20 wheels and boxes with everything, you know, all of our equipment. And I couldn't figure out what the factories were bringing. You know, why did they have so much more stuff? So that was kind of fun. We packed up our boxes as fast as we could. I had a nice dinner on Sunday night, and I went out and listened to some music, and just I actually watched a German movie that kind of showed the differences between East Germany and West Germany before they had reunified. Hmm. And I hadn't really realized that the Sachsenring race is deep in East Germany. And it's a different atmosphere. The people are a little different, and in a lot of ways, it's still kind of,
East European.
But there's a lot of, it's different. I liked it in a lot of ways, and then I found out you can't bring handcuffs onto an airplane, which kind of boggled my mind. Thank you, German security guards, for pointing that out.
Was that something that you were able to take out of your luggage for the flight back?
Yes, because I put a Zippo lighter in my check-in luggage, and that came up on the security screen, too. So what ended up happening is the Germans hauled me away in, you know, if you can imagine Das Boot or something like that. They led me down narrow hallways at the airport to go undo my luggage. And then I unloaded everything, showed them my lighter, and they said, okay, you know, and they dismantled the lighter, took the flints out, took everything apart and then put it back together and handed it to me and said, you can take this on the plane now. And I'm just thinking, wow, I'm taking a Zippo on the plane, but God damn it, you better put those handcuffs in the suitcase. I actually own the handcuffs. They're a gift from a sheriff here in California. And when I sleep on trains or planes, when I don't want to lose my equipment, I lock it to the seat. I lock my bag to the seat. That's what I use the handcuffs for.
Likely story.
But, hey, you'd be surprised what happens. After my wallet got stolen, I've become increasingly paranoid about losing any of my gear. And my computer is the most important thing that I've got overseas. You know, it's my connection to the rest of the world, my connection to my friends and family back here. And my computer's been experiencing problems for the last couple of months with the hard drive actually clicking and clacking away inside of my laptop.
That's not good.
You know, every now and then it wouldn't load up, and it wouldn't even load the operating system, and I was like, oh, no. But, you know, after a couple of days, it would start up again. So I brought my computer limping back to California, and that's why I haven't been posting too much in the last few weeks, because I finally managed to get all the information off of that hard drive, and tomorrow I get to install a new hard drive in my laptop. And if anybody that messes around with computers can tell you, what's supposed to be an easy job just always, always spirals out of control. So it's been a rebuilding process as far as my finances, talking with the bank, getting my credit cards, trying to get caught up on all the late payments that they've charged me, because even though they closed my accounts online, they still expected payments, and it's not really feasible from overseas to do it that way. When, you know, the only way I've been doing it before is with online payments. But at least by tomorrow, the computers hopefully will be okay. And then my finances will be squared away, and I'll be back to just doing everything online so I can be a ghost and be anywhere in the world and still take care of the Liam adventures in California with banks and whatnot. But it's been a busy time after the Laguna Seca race. Definitely, the heat was just intense.
Yes, it was.
Highest recorded track temperatures. Not the best resurfacing. So a lot of things came into play into that race. And
you're being relatively kind.
Just made it difficult for me.
Yeah.
Well, I have so many good friends at Scramp. I have nothing but golden things to say about Scramp.
Sure.
They did their best.
They did. And
it's a difficult
and in fact,
thing to get.
I've first started going to see the GPs when they returned back in the mid late 80s, and right. I didn't miss one until last year's with their return. And I remember exactly what the track was like because I'd been going to see races in the early 80s there as well. And the change that's occurred over the years has been fantastic. And there were expectations from last year to this year that probably mostly due to the weather, which was amazingly painful as far as the heat goes, just weren't able to materialize. And I remember when I first saw you, this is kind of an interesting thing. I talked to you before the race by phone at Laguna Seca.
Right.
And I walked up to you after FP1, FP2 on Friday afternoon. And I walked up and I said, "Hey, Liam." And you looked up at me without ever having seen me, I don't believe, maybe pictures perhaps. And he said, "Hey, Jim." I was like, "That's cool." Go ahead.
One of my strange talents that I don't know why, but I can remember people's names related to their online names, to their avatars, to their voice. And generally I'm better recognizing people's faces, but I do a really, I'm really lucky that I'm able to remember people that are involved with motorcycling. You could introduce me to the president of Sears, I wouldn't know who he was the next day, but if it's motorcycle related, my autism or my moto savantness kicks in, and it sticks in my head. So yeah, it was good to meet you on that Friday. And at this point, Friday afternoon, it was already warm. People have said that it really kicked in on Saturday, but I'll tell you, every day there was hot. Oh, back to my story about packing up our boxes in Germany. Packed up all our stuff, get to California, and we get here on Monday night. And it was a great flight. We had guys from Dorna on the plane. Factory Ducati was on the plane. Some Kawasaki factory guys were there. Some Camel Yamaha guys were on the plane. It was a MotoGP flight. You know, we took over the flight. And free drinks, international, people walking around, stretching their legs, just having a good, good flight. About as relaxed as I've ever seen any of these guys get. And everybody knew that, California, it's what a lot of insiders consider to be the most beautiful race of the year, because the guys that went last year had nothing but beautiful things to say about Monterey and Santa Cruz and everywhere along the coast. So because there's a break after this race, a lot of people stayed from different teams. So everybody was excited to go to California. Plus, the exchange rate made it good for Europeans, and generally things are cheaper here anyway. The people were excited. You know, it's such a the land of opportunity and the land of consumerism, so everybody kind of knew what they were getting into. part of my team had never been to the United States before, so I had told them all these stories and arranged hotel rooms for them to stay after the race and just took them around, you know. Here's Alcatraz, here's the Golden Gate, here's, you know, some important things in San Francisco. Here's Sears where you can buy Craftsman tools. Here's a photography shop where you can buy a camera lens. Just it was amazing that to them that normally in Europe stores don't carry a lot of stock and things, and you have to order online or, you know, find some way to get them. But, you know, in America, whatever you want,
you
can buy it. And it's kind of eye-opening. Not only that, but, you know, to walk around amidst a group of buildings that are 40-plus stories tall here in San Francisco was a trip, because it seems like in the south of Europe there's a mandate that says everything's got to be 8 stories tall and exactly the same height and shape as the building next to it in the European cities. So a little, they've got some tradition there. But we get there on Monday. We had Tuesday to kind of recover from jet lag because, you know, we don't want anybody to have bad jet lag and drop the ball when it comes time to get to work. And, you know, people splintered off and went to different cities to do shopping, or Hoffman, who's personally sponsored by Fox, had to go to the Fox outlet, so he brought the team a bunch of gifts from Fox. And I went to the Bank of America and started taking care of my bank stuff on Tuesday. So Tuesday was a working day for me, and I got down to Monterey Tuesday late afternoon, early evening, and had difficulties getting my room, but come to realize that we'd lost a team member along the way because of some passport issues coming out of Europe to come to the U.S. So we were a man down, and it was the guy that has the same job as me, but that works for the other rider on my team.
Sure.
So, you know, it fell to me. Not only was I doing some coordination and translating for my team here in the U.S., but they said, hey, you know, we need somebody. If you got somebody in mind that you know and trust, bring them in. So I called, you know, one of my oldest friends here in California that I know is mechanically minded, and put him into service working for the team, which meant more work for me. I thought, oh, this will be a nice race. No convoy trucks, no hospitality, nothing to worry about but the race. But then I had to train him and to do his job at the race on a race weekend, and then, you know, naturally do both jobs at the same time. So it was a hectic time for me. And every chance I got, I just tried to have a cigarette and relax. So that's Tuesday. Frantically making calls to my buddy. Can you work? What's your wife going to say? Come down. I got a hotel room for you. It's all hooked up. That was Tuesday. Come Wednesday, we go to the racetrack and find out none of our boxes are here because the plane had a mechanical failure in Europe and was delayed flying out of Europe. And then naturally things were stuck in customs, and a couple of the GP teams didn't have all the equipment they were waiting for. So we lost all of Wednesday until late Wednesday night to set up for the race. And usually Wednesday is the day we build our garage. We build our home base at the racetrack. So we were really up a creek come Thursday where we had to assemble our stuff, and then we had to work on the bikes late Tuesday and into Tuesday evening to make sure that we'd be ready to rock and roll on Friday. And we were chasing a couple of different issues with the bikes before, but just being away from our semi-trucks and, you know, the European community made it more difficult for us to fix them here in the U.S., plus we'd had the late start and a late night. It was a really difficult race to start off the race. Then the heat just compounded it. And because we didn't have our own hospitalities where we prepare for, you know, things like crazy weather, we were at the mercy of the track as far as, like, can you bring us more water? We need more things of water. And
sure.
All the teams were having problems with electrical connectors Laguna Seca is the only racetrack I've been to where at the main garages, the water faucet is on pit lane side. If you want to wash anything, you know, you can't wash it behind your garage unless you run a hose through the entire length of the garage up on the ceiling, which is why at Laguna Seca, a lot of people saw people washing things, you know, away from their paddock garages off on the side of a fence. A couple of teams had congregated and made a community wash area. So it was a difficult race for a couple of reasons.
If, if you're washing things in pit lane, especially if they're bike parts or whatnot, you're essentially getting water and oil rolling into pit lane, which is a bad thing all around.
It's just pathetic. But that's a hard word. No, it was just, you know, there was a little drain right there next to the water faucet, but it's just not equipped to deal with washing motorcycle parts, you know, big things like bearings or a swing arm, or even all the wheels. I had a difficult time cleaning all the wheels before we had our tires mounted up. And plus, we'd lost a day, so I lost some of my cleaning time to prep my my stations, my equipment. But it was just really good to be there. I mean, what was different outside of Holland, the racetracks I've been to, nobody gets out of the way. You know, when I'm pushing a wheel cart or anything, just walking through the paddock, people in foreign countries, just, you know, they don't care about anybody but the riders. Like, they'll stand in the way. You can yell, you know, excuse me, please get out of the way, honk, honk, beep, beep, and nobody really shifts. But in the U.S., you know, it's such a good spectacle for American motorcyclists. And you know, even Pedrosa commented on how polite the fans were. I mean, it's a really different element that I don't think Americans realize how crazy it can be overseas, whether you're in an English-speaking country or not overseas. You know, what I consider to be rude might be different than what someone else considers to be rude. But in the U.S., you know, if I said, excuse me, everybody kind of got out of the way, you know, or people were watching even before I even had to say anything. They'd be like, oh, this guy's working, you know, and he's sweating what's left of his hair off, you know, so everybody would just kind of clear a path. Or if I said, excuse me, people in front of me would yell, excuse me, to the people, you know, in their way, and just everybody, it was just really good, really, really good. We just needed more water, and without our hospitality, we ended up eating at the same, there was a little Brazilian barbecue place, kind of halfway through the paddock in the AMA privateer side. So we'd walk out there every day to eat lunch, and it was really cool. They had a nice family working it, and you know, we spoke Spanish and or Brazilian. I kind of had learned Spanish through the Mexicans here, and it was cool. It was really cool. What was really good was to meet everybody. I met a lot of people from MotoGPOD, fans and listeners that, you know, were aware of my story at least, and just wanted to say, hey, you know, nice to meet you. And that was really critical for me to have that kind of welcome back into the U.S. because, you know, the real genesis of my desire to work in GP kicked in at last year's race when I said, you know, by next year I'm going to be back here and I'm going to be working and I'm, you know, going to do whatever it takes to make that happen. And, you know, with enough fingers crossed and enough luck, it happened. But to see people coming up to me and saying, hey, Liam, you know, really cool, really cool. And, you know, I couldn't do anything but smile and just, you know, it was great for me to come back to the U.S. The food was less important than I thought. You know, I thought I'd be craving American food or Japanese food, things that I'm used to eating back here, Asian food. But it was just good to be back amongst American motorcycle riders. And, you know, everybody just, it's warm. It's a warm atmosphere, so I just want to thank everybody that came up and introduced themselves to me or have emailed me pictures after the race and tried to stay in touch. I need to apologize. I haven't been able to answer a lot of emails in the last few weeks because of the hectic schedule I've had. I actually went down to Los Angeles last week to speak with some people about a potential, well, I can't talk about it, but let's just say I went to Hollywood. And then, I hung out with my dad and my brother in Los Angeles and my half-sister and new baby. And it seems like since I've been gone, a lot of people have gotten married and had children. So part of the thing I'm doing is not only making work connections and strengthening connections with potential sponsors for next year, but also trying to spend time with my old friends and meet new children. And it hasn't given me a lot of time to decompress. And I think I'll be back on the internet wagon again as soon as I'm in Europe. But I'm here for a few more days trying to clean things up, and then I go back to Barcelona for a little bit, and then I have to go to the Czech Republic. And I'm stoked.
What day are you heading out of California?
To leave in the US. I'm not sure yet.
Okay. Let's talk just a little bit about the race itself at Laguna Seca. I spent pretty much all of the weekend up in the Corkscrew, Friday on the top, Saturday and Sunday on the bottom, so had a great view of all of the racers, including Alex Hoffman, who you work on his bike with his team. And it, I was watching him at the beginning of the weekend.
That's my bike.
And that is your bike. And I was watching him as the weekend. Well, tell me about the weekend, because leading up to everything and Sunday, I saw him doing one heck of a race, and then things kind of changed a bit near the end.
Well, you know, practice was difficult for everybody on the grid. You know, a lot of focus was on Nicky and a lot of focus was on Rossi to kind of put things together. I mean, I had spoken with Nicky's manager before the practices had even begun at Laguna Seca. And, you know, we both agreed this is for the championship at least, this was a make it or break it race, for everybody involved. I think this was a crucial turning point. And it played out to be exactly that. But as far as prepping Alex's bike, we really relied a lot on Dunlop to bring us something that would work. And it came through. I mean, we were able to put in consistent lap times with what Bridgestone had brought. And during the race, we had passed Pepe Gibernel. We were 6 seconds up, almost 7 seconds ahead of him. And we had earned a top 10 finish. We were in 10th place. So my crew was ecstatic. And
yep.
On the last lap of the race, you know, we ran out to pit wall. So we were cheering all the riders as they came over the finish line and just everybody on pit wall. You know, elated after such a rough start to the week and 5 races in 6 weeks, this was, you know, the greatest gift we could have gotten. Like, wow, top 10 finish. We earned it. That's our bike, you know. All the hard work coming through. And unfortunately, where the track had deteriorated and the tires had shagged by the end of the race, in 10th place, Alex went down. And by the time he remounted and the corner workers push started him, he came around in 14th. So 2 points, better than no points, but, a little bit of a bittersweet end to the race, because one of the things people don't realize is how much the heat affects the engines. And when he didn't come around, we saw Loris go by, and then we saw Sete come by, and we thought, oh, you know, what could have happened? You know, we suspected maybe he ran out of fuel, like last year's incident with Robbie Rolfo running out of gas on the last lap. And part of that has to do with the heat and how taxing it is on the engine, and what you need to do in order to make power in those conditions. So we thought, oh, maybe he ran out of fuel, and, you know, there was nothing on TV. Nobody in the garage had seen anything on the screen, and none of the data that we get on our multi-views had showed us what had happened. So it took us a little while, and by the time he came back into the garage, you know, we'd learned that he'd fallen down, and that meant, well, at the end of the race, everybody just kind of congratulated one another that we finished and packed everything up. we didn't have time to fix our bike, but we packed up and had a nice dinner on Sunday night after the race with everybody. And I don't know, the only quote that you hear often after, you know, something maybe negative happens is, well, that's the race. And it's frustrating on some levels, because as much as we do have a measure of control over a lot of things, and these are the most adjustable, tunable motorcycles available, you know, that's the race.
And, let me ask you a bit of a technical question here. I know during QP, probably about maybe halfway or two-thirds of the way through, Alex's bike quit and ended up on the, I believe, the outside of turn, or I'm sorry, inside of turn 4, and he was kind of trapped out there. And I was wondering
right.
at that time if that
no
had something
that
to do
with either.
Okay, and then
that was.
But on top of that, you guys made some very specific changes for race day to try and battle the heat. And is that something you can talk about as well?
Well, I think it's it's public domain. All the photos taken. We were running without a front fender. The Desmos Adichie is built for aerodynamics, and you know we run a large front fender, and with the amount of heat that the motor was generating, and the amount of heat that was on the racetrack, and just the temperature of the air, we opted to run without a fender. One, to kind of, well, marginally cool the brakes, but mostly to get as much air to the radiators as we could, just so that our engine would run cooler and we'd be able to make as much power as possible for the conditions. So we ran without a fender. And to me, no one really noticed that. I don't know who looks at the front of a bike anyway. But it was just a little bit of irony because of what happened to Rossi in Shanghai when he came back into the pit with a tire problem. And, you know, a lot of forums, a lot of boards in the U.S. were like, how could those guys not notice a front fender was missing? Well, you only have a couple of seconds. And, you know, right decision or not, when the number one guy in the world points at the rear and says, hit it, you know, there's only one thing on your mind, and that's what can I do to facilitate helping everybody change that faster? You know, whether it's the guy that stands there and grabs the tire warmer after the guy takes it off the tire, or some guy that runs and brings the tire, you know, they're not doing a once-over on the bike. Obviously, he didn't crash. He comes in saying, tire problem, fix the rear. Bam. The whole crew jumps and says, okay, rear tire. Bam. And, you know, nobody really noticed that we ran without a fender for the entire race. And, you know, maybe some others did as well, but you got to look carefully.
Hey, you know, as long as you guys meet the weight limits and it's within the rules, more power to you. You guys did not expire in a clouded heap upon the tarmac, and there were some other bikes that did. So congratulations to that and to you guys.
About that. Thank you. Thanks. We finished in the points. What's interesting about Rossi's failure, and I don't want to be a conspiracy theorist, but this is after in Sachsenring when he was reported as saying, you know, this year working with Michelin and Yamaha, it's been a disaster. That was a huge statement to make in this business, and he detracted it a few days later, which I think it was just a hot day at the end of the day. Maybe he said it because it's been frustrating for those guys. But it's very interesting that there was an engine and a tire failure not related to each other during the race of Laguna Seca. And every time I see somebody say, well, he pushed the tire too hard early in the race and that's why it failed later in the race, I don't put much stock in that. But I do know that, knowing what I know now about the development and of where money kind of goes, and I know that Yamaha has probably had to make some changes to get their bike to run near the front engine-wise. I think their engines are higher strung this year than in years past, and maybe that's has accounted for two engine failures in one year. We do everything we can, and I know those guys, especially with Burgess, they do everything they can to make it as competitive as possible, and unfortunately, he didn't finish the race. So, I don't know. I think Pedrosa had the race of the day because, you know, you look at Nicky's progression. He got out a big lead on everybody eventually, and just pretty much he owned the race, it's fair to say. But Pedrosa really had to fight and work his way past a couple of people to get to second, and I liked watching those battles quite a bit in the race. Because everybody that he had to pass and deal with, you know, is a contender, or will be a contender. And I think he did a really, really good job. You know, a lot of people spoke about his physical prowess and at the beginning of the season. And in these conditions, how hot it was and how much heat the bikes give off. People don't realize how much heat comes off the bikes while they're running or even just, you know, warming up in the garage. It took a lot for him to do what he did. I think he had a great race as well. So hats off to both the Repsol riders. Hats off to my guy, man.
Yeah, I was personally amazed.
Who wants to wear leather black?
Yeah. watching not only the newcomers to the track, both Pedrosa and Stoner, but I was very interested to see what Melandri would do coming back to a track that he, frankly, had lambasted, hated, screamed to the heavens was a horrible track. And indeed, he had a horrible race there last year. I'm not sure how many times he went down. I think it was at least three, two in practice and one in the race. But Pedrosa, brilliant job. Stoner, brilliant job and an amazing qualifying run. Vermeulen, absolutely brilliant. Just, you know, seeing the rookies, it was awesome. And in fact, I ended up rooming with a Australian corner worker. He tossed him in my RV because he didn't have a place to stay. And after on Saturday night, he and I were looking at each other like, this is awesome.
It is. The amount of talent that's on the grid at any race this year is just phenomenal. And I've been a fan of Vermeulen after watching clips of him. His front wheel control, his bike control is amazing. Stoner is also amazing. All these guys are so good, and they've been so flexible in learning how to ride these machines this season that it... Well, Kenny Roberts came back swinging, too. That was also really cool. Love that Easy Rider helmet he had on. But, yeah, the amount of talent that's on the grid right now... It just keeps getting better every year. It's amazing that as much as the bikes and the tires advance, riders advance to take advantage of that and push the envelope even further. And Stoner just had a great, great run. I mean, lap after lap, if you look at the lap times, he was just doing so well. Unfortunately, he didn't get it done during the race, but, yeah, that kid's fast.
One of the things that I was joking about with people, and I look at Stoner and I look at Vermeulen, and I do the tipping competition at rideon2.com, and who I typically choose to be first out is the people that I consider an overachiever. And I was very tempted to take Stoner. I said, no, everybody else is going to take him. So I, in fact, picked Tomato, which was not the right call. And... bad there, but yeah, no, the depth of talent and the view that I had, I mean, literally on the inside of 8A, the bottom of the corkscrew, and these guys are going by me at full song from about 15 feet away, and in fact, I'm getting blasted with their exhaust as they're ripping through. It was just a great weekend for me, and unfortunately, I wasn't close enough to you to come by and say hello, but granted, you had a job that you were doing, as you say, you were doing two jobs nearly. So, Laguna Seca's done. Great weekend. I'm glad to be out of that heat. It was just brutal. And you're hanging out in California. You're getting things done. What's up for you now? You're getting ready to head back to Barcelona and then on to Czechoslovakia.
Yeah. Well, yeah, the Czech Republic. This race has a lot of people excited within the community, the GP community. One, it's Rossi's title hopes appear to be out, so now we're going to see the man at work, not working for a championship, but just hopefully going back to having fun and playing with the bike and just enjoying himself completely without the stress of a championship. It's also the time for Hayden to really, really put the hammer down and lock out anybody else for the rest of the season, because both the Repsol riders are close. And all it takes is one bad race. Either way, for it to, I think, make the season. Plus, people say that the community in that part of Eastern Europe is really, really cool. That everyone said I'm going to have a great time in Brno, and I can't wait. You know, as much as I'm enjoying being back in California, you know, I have all my luggage spread out and a bed just covered with clothes, even now while we're talking, because I'm starting to prep for getting out of here. And, yeah, I can't wait. I'm really pumped. I'm actually pumped because I'm starting to hear things about the 800s. I'm starting to hear a lot more about World Superbike. You know, the silly season is definitely about to hit. And really, all the decisions for next year start to be made at Brno. With teams talking to riders and then building teams around the riders that they feel will work together well. And, a lot of anticipation coming up. As much as I was excited to come back to Laguna Seca to be with friends and family and you know, my home. As far as work, career-wise, the Bruneau race, I'm really anticipating to see what happens there. I know there's going to be a lot of changes and a lot of good things in store for World Superbike next year that I can't really disclose. And the same is true for GP. I think we probably will see a reduction in lap times the first year out, but we're going to see different things, you know, in the corners and under braking, and I think the racing will be even closer than it is now. And to me, this year has just been the ultimate, not only because I'm involved, but even as a fan, just watching the races and seeing how close so many of the finishes are. For the last 15 years, you know, generally one guy goes away, walks away. You know, and maybe there's a couple of scraps here and there for other positions, but so many races this year have been so close, the finishing margins, and people battling all race long on different tire brands, different motorcycle brands. It's been phenomenal. And I think next year when they go back to 800, you know, everyone's going to start on the same foot, and maybe some people will be ahead of other people, but this year it's really come together. I think everybody's kind of found where they need to be at, and I'm talking to you, Shinji Nakano. I hope the green gets up there just for balance, you know.
Actually, you know, that's interesting because pulling way back to, we didn't talk about Sachsenring very much, but that was a race where there were some people up in the front that we were pretty surprised to see there. And things kind of changed around, specifically when Roberts and Tomata got together. But without even going down that road, I agree with you. I think that this is a very exciting season. I'm sorry that through whatever machinations and machine issues and whatnot, that perhaps Rossi isn't up there. But I don't completely count him out yet. He is not mathematically out of the championships. Yeah. And I think anything that happens with him pushing forward is going to make things even more exciting. So, listen, this has been fantastic, and I'm so glad to have had a chance to catch up with you.
And,
yeah, it's been cool. And just so you know, and we talked briefly before this that I've talked to Bob, and poor Bob hasn't even had a chance to see the Laguna Seca race and doesn't even know the finish yet. And so I've been kind in not passing him information that I would love to chat with him about. But he is a very busy guy, and he sends his best. And so I need to wrap this up. I'm kind of jumped out of a dinner party that I'm having here. And Liam, thank you so much for calling, and let's make sure we try and do this again soon. And good luck with your time left here in California, and get ready to kick some ass overseas in the Czech Republic and beyond.
Thanks so much, Jim. It's been great, and I know I just want to say thank you to the people that listen to MotoGPOD. I want to say thank you to Bob and you, Jim, and just everyone else that's been involved with this craziness that's been going on. And it has been a crazy time with so much action all the time that it's good to know that there are still people in the U.S. that stay active, whether they're on forums or just listening to GPOD. It's not IPOD, it's MotoGPOD. But yeah, thanks everybody for listening, and I hope everyone keeps enjoying the races as much as I do. I'm still as passionate, if not more, than I've ever been about the racing, and I can't wait to see what the future brings. So everybody stay tuned, and I think we've got a great season to look forward to.
All right, for those of you still here with us, thanks a bunch for downloading this, and thanks for listening. Again, Brno is coming up this weekend. The title fight is still up in the air. There are 150 points for grabs. I do want to mention that Bob Monkey from RideOn2.com had some brilliant, brilliant photos of the USGP. And if you haven't seen them, I highly suggest you go do so. You can do that by going to RideOn2, that's RideOnTwo.com, www.rideon2.com. Go to the forum section, okay, not too hard, and look at the MotoGP section. You'll see a thing that says USGP photos. If you miss it, I will try and include an URL with this podcast. It's a little bit difficult because I'm still having problems there, but trust me, I'm working on it, and Bob's trying to help out. And again, my apologies. If you want to yell at me, send an email to race@motogpod.com. There's not a whole lot, you know, I'd love to be able to hand some parts of this off, but I found that that's extremely difficult because there's a whole mishmash of putting the thing together. So, yeah, once again, my apologies. I will try and do better. I will absolutely do my best to do a Brno wrap-up next weekend and have some more information, including all of my fun that I had at the USGP, which is, although it might be late, it's better late than never because I had a great time. Thanks for putting up with me. Once again, this is Jim Race for MotoGPOD.com, the internet radio show all about motorcycle road racing. Take care and have a great weekend.
Oh, geez, got the tape in there backwards here. One more time.
MotoGP is a trademark of Dorna Sports SL. The MotoGPOD podcast and MotoGPOD.com are not affiliated with Dorna Sports SL. All other trademarks are the property of their respective owners. MotoGPOD isn't affiliated with any of them.